If you have a question, you may step to the microphone. We have a few minutes for questions.
Good morning.
Oh, my gosh.
I'll step back a little bit. Is there any way to reverse the past 30 years? And if so, how? To both of you.
I'll just say, I think we probably need 400 and something different legislators in the Congress and a different political system in this country. Maybe Naomi has a more concrete, I think it's metastasized so quickly, particularly over the past 8 years, and is embedded so deeply in every entity of the federal government that I actually think that the only way really to confront it at this point is through grassroots action. As sort of romantic as that may sound, I put more faith in the people that I've met in 2 years of traveling the country that are out in the streets regularly than I do in any single member of Congress.
Well, I do think that that campaign finance radical reform is a huge part of it. Also, access. Because I think it is really connected to the part of the reason why there is so little grassroots activism in this country and why the labor movement is so weak. To me, it's really heartbreaking to see the unions pour their money into buying advertisements for political candidates on corporate media, on CNN and all of these networks. Think about how that money could be spent in this moment doing popular education across this country about what's really going on with the bailout, right? And that is a role that the labor movement used to play, used to really take popular education seriously. And that really isn't compatible with bankrolling the Democratic Party. So it's all interconnected. Why do you have to pay money to access the public airwaves? And so I think that should really be the number one push. I mean, we can make a huge list of all the things that we'd like to pressure Obama on. But I feel like this is the demand that makes all the other demands possible, is really trying to change how the system works and breaking this cycle. But in terms of whether we can reverse, whether there are things that can be done to deal with a financial crisis, absolutely. I'll tell you, it's not necessarily bad news to wake up one morning and realize that you're part owner of the banks. That actually can be an opportunity. Think about how the International Monetary Fund responds when countries come asking for a loan, right? They have a list of demands. And we are not making any demands of all of these companies that are coming to Washington asking for a handout. But think about the demands that could be made about protecting jobs, about alternative energy, about CEO salaries, about regulation. So this is actually a moment of opportunity. And when you look at something like, the G20 meeting going on right now, which is just one big photo op and nothing's going to come of it, think about what could happen if there was real leadership. And you could be taxing currency speculation. You could be creating new revenue sources to pay for your Green New Deal, right? So every time there is a crisis, there is an opportunity to move forward. And I'm certainly not arguing that there's something inherently wrong with change in the midst of crisis. All of these crises that we're facing, whether it's the economic crisis or it's climate change, or it's the fact that we have more and more wars over scarce natural resources and more blowback from those wars, all of these are messages telling us that the system is broken and we need to fix it. And if we think about the history, the progressive history of this country and the fact that the market crash of 1929 created the institutions that are now being systematically dismantled in this counter-revolution, we remember that it is possible to respond to a crisis with precisely that type of grassroots activism and demands for real political change, but not, if we wait for it to be handed down from on high. We're in this moment where we're finally realizing that trickle-down economics really doesn't work. Well, trickle-down politics doesn't work any better. And I think it would be a real tragedy if all of that energy that brought Obama to power, like I said, just went home. I was asked by The Guardian, what's my advice for the new president? And I said, free your base and the rest will follow. But the truth is that is a liberation that is not going to be handed down from on high. It's going to come from below, and it's going to become from people breaking free from this idea that change only comes from elections.
Can you also talk about the role of the...
But let's give other people a chance, only because there's a lot of people in a short time.
Yeah, very quick question. This is for both of you. What, in your opinion, how much leeway do you feel Obama has to make real change in this country?
Look, more than anyone in recent memory, you know, more than anyone since FDR, they have no one to blame but themselves from here on in. They, the Democrats, right? Yeah, I mean, the Supreme Court's going to be the biggest obstacle if they really get serious about change. But it isn't just the fact of controlling Congress and the Senate and the White House. It is the crisis itself and the global demand for change. You know, we talk about this economic crisis and this rejection of this economic model as if it just began a few weeks ago, right? But, you know, thinking about what Jeremy just said, you know, when we were here, when we were last in Miami together during the protests against the free trade area of the Americas, well, think about that, right? I mean, that was a meeting in this city with representative of heads of states from every country in Latin America except for Cuba, who were all signed on. This was 2003. To the idea of creating a free trade agreement that would stretch from Alaska down to Tierra del Fuego, 34 heads of state. Is there a politician in the Americas who would publicly endorse the free trade area of the Americas? That's because this economic model is in such profound crisis around the world. And those alternatives are being built in Latin America. They're moving beyond just the critique and actually implementing alternatives to what they call neoliberalism, which is the phrase that they use to describe this economic model, because liberalism means something different in most parts of the world than here. So I think that he has a lot of leeway born of that international context as well as the national context. Frankly, I think there's no excuse not to move forward. I think this is a once in a, you know, more than generation opportunity. And blowing it would be a terrible tragedy. But the pressure he's under to have the smooth transition, I mean, how quickly did it happen to this celebration of change, this victory for change, but he has to govern from the middle, right? But there has to be, you know, continuity, and we have to bring in people like Larry Summers, who the market trusts, right? And the market trusts him because they know he won't do anything radical, as it were. So you know, that's what we're up against. And I think we should be very suspicious of this fake consensus that is really about undermining what people have just voted for.
See, I have a little bit of a different take on it. I mean, Naomi is the optimist in this crew. And that's actually saying something. But, I usually give out razor blades when I talk. I think that We have to, rather than sort of presuming what we think Obama will do, we have to actually look at history, because we have to get away from the cult of personality analysis about Obama, because I think it's much more serious than that. And the White House is never about one individual, as Dick Cheney told us. It often is about two people, or just Dick Cheney, or, you know, however you want to. But what we have some historical analysis that can be applied to this situation. I talked about in brief about Obama's foreign policy team. The same can be said for the economic team. The various people that are being floated around, we know almost all of these people that are being discussed for cabinet posts, because many of them already have been there and done that, and done it in a way that really was devastating to the world. The 90s laid the groundwork for much of the terrible policy making that happened when Bush was in the White House. The Patriot Act, Clinton laid the groundwork for it. Clinton started the Extraordinary Rendition Program. You had the targeting of Iraq for the entire 8 years of Clinton's presidency. Through economic sanctions and bombing. You had the attack on Yugoslavia, the dismantling of that country. You know, what I'm getting at, the bad politics toward Haiti, is that the people that are now being brought back in have a militaristic view of the world. Vince Harding, who wrote Martin Luther King's speech against the Vietnam War, was saying that this is the issue that separates any comparison of Obama and Martin Luther King, is that Obama accepts that militarism is a solution to world problems, and that's why he will never be a Martin Luther King type figure. And that's what Vince Harding was saying the other day. And I find that interesting in the context of the idea that this is somehow an incredibly unusual situation. The Democrats swept Congress in 2006. We saw what they can do when they have power in the Congress, and that is to get an approval rating lower than President Bush. That was Nancy Pelosi's crowning achievement as her time as House Speaker. So I think that the forces that propelled Obama to victory are something to take tremendous hope in. I mean, I have met so many incredibly energized people across this country, and I would put my faith in those people and in trying to sustain that movement. If the Democratic Party co-ops social movements and swallows them up, democracy has taken a massive hit in this country. We have a real moment, and I think it's a matter of looking beyond partisan politics and fighting for the direction we want our country to take. So I don't put it as what can Obama do as much as what can we do, and more importantly, I think, what can we stop from happening? Thank you.
Okay, my question's to both of you. The question I'm asking is that right now we have lots of people that have committed crimes in the Bush administration, okay, and we need to have them, you know, maybe be indicted and investigated, and the Judicial Committee is failing to do all of that, okay? My question is that suppose, okay, Bush uses the nuclear option of blanket pardon. How will we get all of these people?
Well, I mean, I like some of the images that Naomi, you know, that Naomi threw out about sort of burning of the place before they leave it. I think that Bush is going to try to cover up for the crimes that he's committed and the crimes that others in his administration have committed. There's no question. And I'm going to be very interested to see the pardon list as he leaves the White House, like who's going to get pardoned for all of their crimes. The reality is, I don't think that the Democrats are going to go after them in this way. I actually think that the best people on this issue are people like Michael Ratner at the Center for Constitutional Rights. These guys have been suing Rumsfeld, and they plan on suing Cheney and Bush in Europe after they leave office. I mean, they want to make it so that these guys cannot leave the United States or step foot in Europe. I mean, you remember the story when Pinochet was put under house arrest in Europe. There were these reports that Henry Kissinger was afraid to leave the United States because he was afraid that it would happen to him if he goes there. When Rumsfeld went to Germany recently, there was a major problem because Rumsfeld was going to be slapped with this lawsuit. So while we may have nowhere to go inside of the United States, I would put my faith in the brave men and women who are the lawyers of the Center for Constitutional Rights. They are going to pursue these guys, like they say they're going to pursue Bin Laden to the edge of hell or whatever. They're going to pursue these guys to the edge of hell, and they're going to try to prosecute them and hold them accountable. But I would put much more faith in them than I would in any official entity in Washington to do it.
Well, I think it might behoove us to think of the president as a high-level middle manager in all of this. And we've just been through a record two-year period of a presidential campaign where it boiled down to, and with all the murder and the thievery and everything going on, it boiled down to Bill Ayers and Joe the Plumber. And I think we have to look at ourselves. And my question is, do you think it's time? Because the only people who were silenced during this campaign were the people who wanted to talk about the war and the torture and Katrina and That's everything right. else. Isn't it time for a third-party movement to take up this wave and move forward? Because I don't think the answers are going to come out anymore of these two very sick parties.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to take that? I mean, obviously, no fundamental change is going to happen in this country unless we break the duopoly. I mean, I totally agree with you on that. But this is a huge question on how you do that. I mean, we saw, Cynthia McKinney came in last, and she ran on the Green Party ticket. She came in sixth place, I think. Nader got 1% of the vote and was the highest number of votes of any independent running for office, less than 1%, basically, or 1% in some places. I think it's despicable when people attack Ralph Nader, for instance, for running for president. Ralph Nader has every right to run for president. He did not lose the 2000 election. It was stolen, and the Democrats refused to stand up and fight it in the streets. Having said that, I think that, in many ways, it can't be trickled down either. I think that, it has to be the battles waged at local levels, starting at school boards and moving up and trying to get people in the Congress. And this is a long-term fight, and there are great activists that are trying to build it. whether it's a third party or it's some kind of an independent network of people that are running for offices around the country. Obviously, we need that. And the fact that that the voices that you identified, the anti-war voices, the anti-torture voices, the people that are about a real social justice movement, their voices were not heard in this campaign. Obama talked 5% of his speeches dealt with Iraq and Afghanistan. The New York Times did an analysis at the end. He almost never talked about these issues and, in fact, continued to praise John McCain as a war hero and to praise John McCain for standing up about torture. That was the old John McCain. The new John McCain supports that kind of torture, but Obama continued to repeat that. So you had no sense of the issues that brought people into the streets represented on the big stage oftentimes. And that's a problem, and it's a serious problem. But I do agree with you. I think that we need to crack this system. Strategically, there's a serious question on how you do that, because this year, I think, was a pretty clear, we got a pretty clear sense that simply running a presidential candidate every 4 years is not the way to build a multi-party movement in this country.
There's a widespread myth that the dollar is printed by the federal mint and the government enters it into circulation, when in fact only banks enter the dollar into circulation. They do it by issuing debt, and the only way to pay it back is by borrowing more money. There's a documentary about this called Money as Debt. I was wondering if you could explain this better than I did, and perhaps make it your next book. And if this isn't the time to take the dollar, which is in essence privatized, and nationalize the U.S. currency so that only the government can issue money, and perhaps eliminate the fractional reserve margin, is that the way to nationalize the dollar and end the debt cycle, which is a catch-22 situation?
Well,
if this isn't the time, then will there ever be a time when we can do that?
Honestly, it's not my area, and I'm not going to pretend that it is, so I'm going to treat that as a comment and encourage you to read my colleague William Grider's wonderful book about the Federal Reserve. This is his area, and it was interesting. I was on a panel organized by The Nation recently, Bill, and Bill was saying, you know, that he wrote this book, I think, 18 years ago, and suddenly everyone is, you know, it has been this upsurge of interest in how the system actually works. I'm pleased to report that sales are going very well. So read Bill Grider. He's been also writing fantastic stuff about the bailout and the Federal Reserve, but I'm going to leave it there, and we'll try to squeeze a couple more in.
Hello. Our nation used to have a great ethic for bringing for justice. We're doing the right thing, and everyone gets a fair trial. And if someone commits a crime, then they should be punished, obviously. We have, in the Bush administration, a criminal administration, guilty clearly of war crimes, and even John Conyers admits it's not a matter of information. It's just they're thinking about it.
Yeah.
So I was wondering why you think that they are so spineless and unwilling to do justice for the American people.
I mean, I think it's a very interesting question. I mean, I definitely think that Conyers had intended to pursue impeachment at a minimum, but probably a wider-ranging investigation. And I do believe that the fact that Pelosi laid it down right from the jump, pulled the rug out from under all of those members of Congress, including some from Florida, who were very pro-impeachment. I think part of it has to do with the way politics works, you know, that there's sort of this gentleman's agreement that you're not going to sort of go after people, you know, after the fact. But they didn't even go after them while they were in power, and that's a really serious problem. On the issue of, you know, the lack of prosecutions of these private forces that have committed all these, you know, war crimes, Blackwater, Triple Canopy, Dying Corps, like these corporate forces that have been deployed, you know, there's a complete lack of political will at the Bush Justice Department. Of course, they're not going to prosecute these guys for war crimes, even though they could prosecute them under the War Crimes Act. But then there's also the fact that it would be bad for business, for the war business. If you start going after people for war crimes, that are on your payroll working as private soldiers in the war zone, you're going to undermine the whole system of corporate involvement in the war machine. So, I think that those two are related. The idea of the lack of prosecution or investigation of the crimes of this administration and the lack of prosecution of the crimes of these private forces, I think they all ultimately stem from the fact that both of these parties adhere to the same basic rules of the game. And I think that's one of the shameful things about the political system in this country.
It is really interesting that this is coming up so much. And I think in some ways it's the euphoria of the election is wearing off, and we're starting to realize that they lost the election, but they won a lot, and they're going to get away with it. And there's something really terrifying and terrible about watching people get away with crimes on this scale. And we're really feeling the compromises, because they even got away with it in the campaign itself. I mean, this is part of the winning strategy of running such a safe campaign. You know, how did Obama win this election? Well, one of the ways he won was by giving in on so many important issues that he never gave the Republicans anything that they could really sink their teeth into, and that's why they ended up with Bill Ayers. Because he caved on FISA. They would have had a field day with FISA.
Bill Ayers was against it.
And even something like offshore oil drilling, as soon as it was clear that was going to be a real difference, Obama gave in. He said he could see certain circumstances where that would be a good idea, just like he gave, he gave retroactive immunity to the telecoms. You know, that's another example of just people getting away with these crimes. I was thinking, the most important symbolic victory after the elections will be if Guantanamo is closed, right? That will be a very, very important day if that happens. But this issue of criminality is central to it. One of the reasons why they haven't closed on Guantanamo yet, and frankly they'd like to, is that they're afraid of the lawsuits that will happen when they admit that they have been holding, hundreds of men there who are not guilty of any crime. If they're not able to transfer those cases into criminal courts, if they're not able to normalize or regularize those cases, it's an admission that they have been torturing people for nothing. Okay? All of those people have massive lawsuits. So the fact that they did not, they're not going to go after them, the Obama administration isn't going to go after them, doesn't mean that released prisoners from Guantanamo can't go after them, right? And I'm sure, CCR is going to be very happy to represent them. So we have to pay very close attention to the deals that are made in how Guantanamo is closed. Are people being asked to agree not to sue the government? Because that's no kind of victory.
I mean, one closing thought on this, and we can go to you, sir. People talk about a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. What we need is an actual Truth Commission, and what the Democrats are going to give us is the Reconciliation Commission, and that's the problem.
A question for Ms. Klein. In view of what you've said about the bank bailout, what are your feelings about the potential bailout of the Detroit automakers?
Well, I think the bailout that's being proposed is not a very good bailout. It's once again, the incredible leverage of this moment is just not being used. And we're not even seeing real demands being made of the auto industry to protect jobs. Really transition to green cars and so it is more free money, unfortunately. But what really shocks me is the way the Bush administration is using it as leverage to push through the free trade deal with Colombia. I mean, the cynicism of this is quite stunning. And I'm actually worried for those of you who don't know, what the Bush administration is doing right now is holding back on bailing out the big three automakers unless the Democrats agree to ratify this free trade deal with Colombia, okay? And it's interesting because this is actually one area where there really was a policy difference, and they're just going after it. I'm quite worried that there is going to be some sort of backroom negotiation here that's pretty ugly because, of course, you know, the labor movement in this country does want the bailout for the automakers, and they are the reason why the Democrats have been pretty good on the Colombia free trade deal. So I'm worried about some horse trading that could happen very, very quickly, brokered by our friend Rahm Emanuel, where basically they say, we'll bail out the automakers, but and you give us Colombia. And that's, you know, that is just nothing resembling democracy. I hope that answers the question. And just, you know, just to come back to something that Jeremy was saying, you know, describing so well the creation of this parallel, the infrastructure of the private contractors, this bailout is completely consistent with the way the Bush administration has governed. That what we're describing here is a government that really treated the state as an ATM, right? And all of these contractors have just been withdrawing money, not even performing the functions that they said that they were going to perform, like reconstructing Iraq or in Afghanistan, but just paying back the government in campaign contributions. And now the bailout really is, you know, the final trough. And, you know, one of the most one of the companies lining up is Giuliani's law firm, you know, and they were, you know, Giuliani was the first to cash in on 9/11, or one of the first. And, you know, I have a quote in this recent piece that I did where they say, that, you know, this one's really big about the bailout. And so, you know, this is one of the things that we've been looking at is, you know, how each disaster becomes, you know, the new opportunity to just loot the Treasury. You had Iraq, you had 9/11, then, you know, Katrina and the same gang shows up. And we have to understand that this is happening again in real time. But it's actually what they're cleaning up after is the mess they've made of the economy.
I think we're going to have to end the questions there. I thank you so very much.
Thank you. Thanks, everybody.
The authors will be autographing on the other side of the elevator.